From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy, broadcasting this week from Monroe, Louisiana. State of Belief airs every weekend on radio stations nationwide and is available as a podcast on iTunes and other leading podcast platforms. I urge you to subscribe to it today. This program is made possible in great part by the generous support of our listeners. If you made a donation this week, thank you. Your support is incredibly important. If you haven't pitched in yet, information on how you can help keep this show on the air is available at stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. Now, here's what's coming up this week on State of Belief Radio.
United Methodist Church said Tuesday that it will not recognize same-sex marriage or gay clergy. More than 800 delegates from around the world met in St. Louis. United Methodist Church is the third largest faith community in the U.S.
For four long and grueling days, a special session of the General Conference of the United Methodist Church weighed critical issues of human sexuality and denominational positions on inclusion of LGBTQ persons in the life of the church. By any measure, the outcome was decidedly conservative, and the UMC is at risk of fracturing. For some understanding of what happened and what happens next, I'll talk with Religion News Service national reporter Emily Miller.
Trust in government was the first thing to go. Washington had loomed large in the previous decades, guiding the nation through crises like the Great Depression, World War II, and the early decades of the Cold War, too. Its vision of a unifying American way of life offered a powerful countervailing force to other lines of division.
I think one of the very last things that all Americans can still agree on is how incredibly divided we have become. The national motto, E Pluribus Unum, may still be on our currency, but if you were to say it out loud in some parts of the country, you'd probably be angrily told to speak English. How has it come to this? Historian Kevin Cruz has spent a long time studying the matter, and his new book, Fault Lines, A History of the United States Since 1974, has just been released as an audiobook. Dr. Cruz will be back with us on this week's State of Belief Radio. But first,
U.S. Supreme Court justices today seemed willing to rule in favor of keeping a cross on public land.
On Wednesday, the Supreme Court heard oral arguments on what many analysts are calling the most significant religious freedom case of the term. A large number of activists were gathered in front of the courthouse that day, including Interfaith Alliance President Rabbi Jack Moline.
I am so pleased to be standing among this amazing coalition of people whose perspectives run the gamut of faiths and philosophies that are protected by the First Amendment to the Constitution. I congratulate the American Humanist Association for gathering us and recognizing, as we do at Interfaith Alliance, that freedom of conscience in this country is absolute, and that the government has no role to play in establishing a preference for any religion or for no religion. That's not just a good idea, it's the law. We at Interfaith Alliance are proud to stand with any individual or group of individuals whose faith commitments have been abused or arrogated by the government. And that's why I'm here today to speak in support of my Christian brothers and sisters who find such deep religious meaning in the Latin cross. It is for them the preeminent symbol of defining religious principles in their lives. No doubt, when the originators of the Bladensburg cross chose that symbol to honor the young men who paid the ultimate price for the defense of freedom, they had in mind the power of their own faith to heal the brokenhearted and give meaning to the sacrifice. But now this privately funded, privately erected, profound religious symbol rests on public land and is maintained by public funds. And the only way that's possible is for the courts, for this court, to declare that because of its long-standing presence, it may be considered less than a marker of Christian faith. This court, dedicated to applying the Constitution fairly and with integrity, would have to strip the cross of its salvific power to devoted Christians in order to make it eligible to rest on public land and be maintained by public funds. Nothing would dishonor the original fallen veterans than to deny the intentions of their families and neighbors. Nothing would dishonor the subsequent heroes more than to suggest that the symbols of their own personal faith, their own personal philosophy, or their own conscience were considered inadequate to acknowledge their sacrifice. Nothing would dishonor the diverse population of modern-day Bladensburg more than to deliver the message that their own sacred symbols might someday be appropriated without their consent. I have long stood with my Christian brothers and sisters who insisted in keeping the Christ in Christmas and in making the imminent holy time of Lent and Easter, when Christians reflect on the meaning of this symbol, about more than bunnies and chocolate eggs. I stand with them now in urging the justices of the Supreme Court to respect the particular meaning of the cross and to order the removal of it from public land.
Well, that's Rabbi Jack Moline, president of Interfaith Alliance, speaking Wednesday on the Supreme Court steps at a rally organized around the principle, honor them all. The justices were hearing a challenge brought by the American Humanist Association to a decades-old Christian monument on public land maintained with public funds in Maryland. The case certainly raises profound issues regarding respect for service members who made the ultimate sacrifice in service to this nation. Some of their surviving family members who feel this case disrespects that sacrifice, and many Americans who recognize the importance of ensuring government never endorses any religion as being a fundamental right protected by that very sacrifice. For a look at what happened in the chambers, I'm joined by attorney and activist Rabbi Jay Michelson. Jay, thanks for being with us again.
My pleasure.
Could you just quickly summarize what the disagreement is all about here?
Sure. So at issue is a cross-shaped memorial that was erected 90 years ago and was originally erected by the American Legion, but now sits on public land. So on the surface, the question is very simple. Is this memorial to World War I dead that's in the shape of a cross a unconstitutional religious display, or is it a secular memorial that is in the shape of the cross but for whatever reason is not unconstitutional?
How did this particular case reach the highest court in the land?
Well, you know, it's a bit of a quirk, actually. The probably the most important of all of these cases was the Mount Soledad Cross, mm-hmm. which is near San Diego.
Yeah.
And it, for whatever reason, and we never know when the Supreme Court declines to take a case, they just didn't take that case. They left it in the with the Ninth Circuit's decision. And, you know, part of it, I think, was that they knew that there was going to be a solution or a workaround, which probably there will be in this case as well. In the case of the Mount Soledad Cross, it was just sold to a private organization, and that made the case moot because, mm-hmm. obviously, it's within a private organization's a large cross as a memorial or anything else for that matter.
Mm-hmm.
Here, there were a few kind of enterprising folks on the liberal side who kind of drive by this memorial, which is quite large. It's a 40-foot cross. It's in a traffic circle, so you see it all the time, and it certainly feels like it's in a public place, and decided that this would be a good test case, although I think it may actually backfire, and I think this case will probably be a win for conservatives rather than for liberals.
Hmm. So what can you tell us about what happened at the court?
So it was actually a bit surprising. I think most of us were looking at this as a liberal-conservative split, and the conservatives have a lot more votes. And the question that I looked at when I was covering the case was, how far to the right would this go? Because I think, you know, on the surface, this is one that reasonable people can really disagree about. And this is a memorial that's been there a long time. Just the symbolism of taking down a cross memorial feels a little bit harsh. You know, I think the odds were always that the cross would remain. Of course, we'll see. We'll find out probably in June what the court really rules. But what was surprising at the court was that actually a couple of the liberal justices, Justice Breyer and then Justice Kagan, seemed to be sympathetic to the idea that while you couldn't put up a new cross memorial now, because it is clearly a religious symbol, values were different in the 1920s when this was erected, and it is true that public money is going to maintain this memorial, and that might not be constitutional to start doing in 2019, but when you're dealing with something that's been there over 90 years, maybe it's actually acceptable. I think now the question is if we see that as kind of a compromise, so that the memorial stays, but the court were to say, well, no more like this, if that compromise gets enough votes, or if we'll have a more right-wing opinion, which could really go quite far to the right. I mean, Justice Thomas has written in an earlier case that he doesn't think the Establishment Clause of the Constitution should apply to states at all.
Yes.
Just think about that for a moment. So, yes. You know, the state of Virginia could declare an official religion and teach it in schools and all of the rest. And that's a very radical point of view, and we don't really know what Justices Gorsuch and Kavanaugh think about it.
If we say, well, if it's old enough, then it has its place whether or not it conforms with what our founders thought.
Yeah, you know, this is one of those unusual kinds of cases where if you really do originalism, right, you really look at what the founders were thinking and saying and doing, normally that leads to a conservative point of view, right?
Yes.
So the founders did not think anything about same-sex marriage, for example. Mm-hmm. So if the only thing we look at is what the founders were thinking about, you end up with a conservative result. But as you just suggested, here, if we look at what the founders thought, they were very careful to keep religious symbols away from official government buildings and government property. They may have been personally religious, but they didn't want to corrupt the church by involving it in the state. And so actually, if we go back, you know, 200 some odd years to what the founders were doing, you would end up with a more left-wing result. You would say, of course, you can't have a huge cross maintained by the government. That's exactly what the founders didn't want. So it's kind of a reversal of the usual case. You know, I think, and I tried to make this point in my article, sometimes I think folks, particularly liberal folks and secular folks, tend to downplay the importance of these symbols.
Mm-hmm.
You know, nobody's really affected one way or the other, you know, by having a cross memorial. It's not the same as, let's say, Roe versus Wade or same-sex marriage, for that matter, which affects millions and millions of people. You know, on the right, though, and I think, you know, religious liberals, religious progressives are caught in between here. You know, on the right, these symbols matter a lot.
Mm-hmm.
The Mount Soledad cross was one of the rallying cries for the redefinition of religious freedom, which you and I have talked about a dozen times.
Yeah.
And that has affected the practical lives of many, many people. So symbols do matter. And it's interesting, I think, as religious progressives to think about how much more they matter to religious folks than to secular folks, at least if, you know, if we sort of just look at the data and what people are worried about. So I am concerned about the proliferation of religious symbolism like this. On the other hand, if the Supreme Court were to announce a compromise and were to say no new crosses because it's 2019, but this has been around for so long that we're going to let it go, you know, I might be okay with that because it would sort of stop the slippery slope from being that slippery.
Is the way this one gets settled having any influence then on the way that the court would deal with slogans on money, slogans on buildings in Washington, or am I stretching too far there?
It's a little too far because those slogans are really safe. There's a word, a term that listeners might enjoy learning, the legal term called ceremonial deism, which is not a word we have, or a term we use a lot. I'm not sure I've said it in 20 years. But that's what the court calls these kinds of things, like In God We Trust on our money, for example. When it's basically non-sectarian, and when it just has a ceremonial function, they call it ceremonial deism, and that's been safe for hundreds of years. I don't think there'd be a single vote on the Supreme Court to take In God We Trust off of our right. off of our money. Yeah. Where it gets thorny, though, is when, you know, the cross is not a neutral symbol, right? That's a symbol of one religion. Mm-hmm. And it's obviously a hugely contentious issue about how much America is supposed to be a Christian nation or not. And so that symbol quickly turns into practical reality for a whole lot of folks. So here it's much more contentious. The next cases on the docket that the courts might be looking at do try to push the envelope further. So, for example, there's a case working its way up of a football coach who leads a prayer at the 50-yard line at the end of every football game. And it's a sectarian prayer. It's a Christian prayer. Mm-hmm. So he's doing it individually. It's not an official school activity. On the other hand, it's on the 50-yard line of a football game right after the football game's over, led by the coach. So that starts to look pretty official. Mm-hmm. So those are those sort of borderline cases that would be impacted by how the court rules here. If the court says that it's constitutional unless somebody's forced to do something, and that's one of the more conservative views on this case, then that coach's prayer stands, right? I'm mm-hmm. not forced to participate in it. I'm not even forced to watch it. If I want to leave the game, I can go ahead and leave after the game's over. So if that's the test, we would have a lot more public displays of religion. We might have more prayers in school or at graduation or things like that, as long as nobody's individually forced to participate. Mm-hmm. So that would be a huge shift. Yeah. So it's really a question, I think, of whether it's the sort of moderate compromise that holds the day, or whether the conservatives on the court, especially Justice Gorsuch, who's written several times that he'd like to see more support of religion, more funding of religion, government funding of religion, and so forth, if they see this as an opportunity to move the court to the right. And I think that's a very real possibility.
Jay, I thought it was curious that defenders of the installation are using language such as, quote, a cross-shaped monument. What distinction are they trying to make there, and why?
Well, it's a huge distinction. If it's cross, if it's just a religious symbol, then this is clearly unconstitutional. You cannot have the government pay to erect a gigantic religious symbol on public land and pay mm-hmm. to maintain it as well. There were some people who did argue that, but that's way to the right of where the current law is. Mm-hmm. The question is, what is this thing? And if it's a cross-shaped memorial, that may sound sort of ridiculous, but it's a distinction with a difference because, mm-hmm. you know, what's the inscription on the memorial? It doesn't say Jesus is Lord. It says honoring our war dead. Mm-hmm. Well, that may matter. You know, this is a symbol. Obviously, it's a religious symbol, but it's a symbol, a religious symbol used for a secular purpose. It just makes this case a little bit more of a gray area. And at the oral argument, there was some dispute, actually, as to how many of these there are, you know, in the country on public land. It seems like there's not a lot. There's about 20 or 30 that remain on public land. Mm-hmm. And, you know, really the best solution is what was done in Mount Soledad, which is just get the government out of this business. There is no reason for the government to be paying for this. There are plenty of the American Legion, you know, paid originally to construct the monument. So they should just buy it back from the mm-hmm. government. It won't be hard to fundraise the necessary amount sure. of money to do the maintenance work yeah. on this memorial. And that solves the problem. And I think that really is what should happen. But again, this was an opportunity for both the left and the right to fight about this symbol. And so that's why we're talking about it. You know, this was created as a case the right decided to fight it. The left initiated the fight. The right decided to fight it rather than compromise. And so now it's in front of the court.
Dr. Jay Michelson is an attorney, author, and activist, as well as a rabbi and meditation teacher. His books include the best-selling God versus Gay, The Religious Case for Equality, and The Gate of Tears, Sadness and the Spiritual Path. Jay's the legal affairs columnist at the Daily Beast, where his column on this case is headlined, Supreme Court Could Bury Separation of Church and State Under a Maryland Cross. And we'll link to that from stateofbelief.com. I am always grateful for you being with us on State of Belief Radio.
Well, thank you. That's very kind. And any chance I get to talk about ceremonial deism, rare opportunity. So thank you.
There's lots more still to come on this week's show. We'll hear from Kevin M. Cruz, whose timely new book is titled Fault Lines, A History of the United States Since 1974. And later, a profoundly contentious set of decisions by the United Methodist Church on inclusion of LGBTQ persons. Religion News Service national reporter Emily Miller will provide an overview. I'm Welton Getty. You're listening to State of Belief Radio, brought to you by Interfaith Alliance. A few years back, it was my pleasure to interview historian Kevin M. Cruz in connection with his insightful book, One Nation Under God, How Corporate America Invented Christian America. And the conversation is well worth looking up at stateofbelief.com. Well, Dr. Cruz has been busy writing about another priority subject for State of Belief, the ever-growing divisions among Americans in a nation that once prided itself on being a melting pot that benefited from the diversity of its ingredients. The new book, Fault Lines, A History of the United States Since 1974, was co-written with Julian Zelizer and has just been released as an audiobook. And I am so pleased it brings the audio version of Kevin Cruz back to State of Belief Radio. Kevin, thanks so much for being with us again.
It's a pleasure to be back with you.
We talk about how painfully divided we've become a lot on this show. And I almost always end up asking, is this split being deliberately deepened to serve an agenda? After looking at your book, I don't think I need to ask you that, because you identify so many differences that make division pretty much inevitable. Is that an accurate way of putting it?
It is an accurate way. And you know, we've always had divisions in America. There have always been fault lines. But, you know, so you've read my earlier book. You know that in that period we had things that really held the country together. The religious nationalism I described in that book was one, but there were some other ones too. A mainstream media that kind of set the stage that everyone agreed on, you know, the big three networks and a couple of big newspapers, that was the media. You had the politics, the parties were ideologically diverse, people believed in the federal government, the economy was working for everyone, it was a union era in which people got lifted up in the middle class, so it worked for everyone. What happens in our new era that we talk about here in this book from 1974 on is that those divisions are there, but you don't have those forces that are holding the country together. The media splits into 1,000 pieces. Our politics becomes more polarized. The economy starts to fall apart, and people are you know, at each other's throats over that. But also, there are people who are deliberately exploiting this. You know, the book starts off at the end of the Nixon era, and they really coined something that is true throughout this period. They called it the politics of positive polarization, and by that they meant if you could get the country to fight with each other. As long as you had the slightly bigger half of the country when it broke in two, you were going to win in politics. And that's something that people from Nixon's time on to today have exploited.
Speak a little bit more about why 1974.
Two reasons. One, the first thing that inspired us to really start doing this book, it came out of a course we co-taught at Princeton together, was really to recognize that enough time has gone by that we need to think about this period since 1974 as its own period. You know, it's been 45 years. And for college students today, that's a long time ago. When I was in college in the early 90s, 45 years before me was the end of World War II.
Yeah.
It's the past, whether people like us want to believe it or not. It's the past. We got to think of it in discrete terms. That breaking point at 74, though, was one that we picked as a starting point for the book, because there are so many moments of fracture that happened around that period. The big one for us as political historians is Watergate and the resignation of Richard Nixon in 1974, which is a huge blow to the political system. But there are a number of other breaks that happened in that same period. 1973 is when the OPEC oil embargo happens, which really shakes America's faith in its economic stability. 1975 is the withdrawal of troops, American troops from Vietnam, the final ones, which really shakes America's belief in its supremacy on the global stage. You've got Roe v. Wade in 1973, the Boston busing riots over race in 1975. So there are a lot of things that go on in this period which really shatter Americans' confidence that had governed the post-war decades and sets up a new era of uncertainty.
I guess there was a certain shift from contempt for different ideas from one's own to contempt for anyone just harboring different ideas.
It really has become a much more hardened and I think hard-edged a debate in the public sphere. And I think one of the reasons for that is this transformation we see in the media. Again, when we start this book out, it's still the period when you've got the big three news networks and just a handful of newspapers providing the general basis of information. And people would disagree on just what that information meant, what to make of those facts, but there was a fundamental agreement on what those facts were. And over the course of this period, we see the media fragmenting over and over again, first with the rise of cable television, then the advent of talk radio, where you, in the wake of the Fairness Doctrine being removed, you have suddenly political views from left to right are being thrown out without any rebuttals. Then to the creation of Fox News in the 90s, and certainly in the age of the internet, where there are not just 500 cable channels, there are a million different options out there, and people can get their facts from wherever they want, and those facts often are wrong. Those facts are often at loggerheads, and so we find ourselves disagreeing not over the meaning of the facts, but just what the facts are to begin with.
And I guess the escalation of conflict that social media has wrought was beyond predictable.
In some ways, it is beyond predictable. But, we see some of the roots of this far back with really that rise of cable. When we talk about the creation of CNN, which goes on the air in 1980, and ESPN is about 1979, and MTV is 81, these are new channels that pioneer a new type of broadcasting, which they actually call narrowcasting. It's a term that MTV advances. Rather than going out and trying to reach as many people as possible and bring them together into some kind of, a common public space, we're instead going to narrowcast. We're going to slice and dice the media audience and find people who just want, basketball news or just want news about rock or whatever, and we're going to slice and dice at that. When you put that into the political sphere, as we have today with political news channels across the political spectrum, that means that you really are leaving people in their own political silos and telling them basically what they want to hear and reinforcing that.
How does morality come into play here? Because there's a real sense of being morally virtuous for holding a certain set of beliefs and a sense that those who hold other beliefs aren't just wrong. They are considered immoral at best and truly evil at worst.
It really is a remarkable change. And again, something that I think sets this period apart from the past, where the sense of morality becomes weaponized. It's not something that is meant to draw people together, but rather, again, as you say, it's I'm moral, you are not. And it's something that really is pioneered by the moral majority, started in 1979, becomes an adjunct of the conservative movement and Republican Party politics. And they really do stake moral claims to things that previously hadn't had those claims. So the fight over abortion and the right to life certainly has a moral underpinning. But they throw it on to things like the Panama Canal or the nuclear test ban treaty or tax reform, things that hadn't had that tone before. Yeah. And so it takes on a certain hard edge. And there are always instincts to reach out to that belief in morality, that kind of spiritual underpinning. You see this something that Barack Obama does in that 2004 address that propels him to national fame, talking about that we're not just red states and blue states. You know, we worship a mighty God in the blue states, and we are our brother's keeper in the red states. He really brings that language and tries to paper over those divisions. It doesn't quite work, but still the aspiration is there to go back to that earlier period in which morality doesn't divide us but unites us.
Where else do you see religious narratives or impulses or language playing a role in this history of division?
If you look back to when the modern religious right got its start, there's that moment at the religious roundtable meeting in Dallas, Texas in August 1980. And James Robeson gets up there and says, you know, I'm tired of hearing about the gays and the lesbians and the liberals and the leftists and the communists coming out of the closet. It's time for God's people to come out of the closet. So it really is framed as a backlash for all of the talk about this being a pro-family, pro-morality, pro-life movement. A lot of the political energy there is one that is really driven by backlash. And that sort of starting point, where you set yourself up in opposition to another political movement, almost sets you on a collision course for an inevitable crash.
You know, I hate to admit it on the one hand, and yes, I do on the other, just to say that wasn't history for me. That was reality, contemporary reality. I knew James Robeson and was in Texas in Fort Worth and could hardly get anybody in the religious community to take him on. And what was going on there. And so it just I remember a night, I'll never forget this, when I was on media with a guy who told me all of the damage that could be done by the canal treaty. And I said, well, where do you get that? And he said, it's right in the Bible. But he couldn't tell me where it was.
That's perfect.
Kevin, you're a historian. If you look back a lot farther than 1974, can you think of an example where a society became as fragmented and contentious as ours and then somehow made it back from the brink?
Sure. Yeah. You know, this is one of the beautiful things about being an historian is that I'm well familiar with how bad things have gotten in the past and know that we picked up the pieces before. So as bad as things are, seem right now, you know, 1968 was a year where it really seemed like the country was coming apart. You had political assassinations, major cities on fire. You had the fights over Vietnam and civil rights. 1919 was another year in which the country was again rocked by labor strikes and race riots and a deadly flu epidemic on top of that, the devastation of the economy and politics after World War One, on and on. With the Civil War, obviously a huge one. So there have been real crisis moments in American history, and I think we can look back to them and take confidence that we're able to rebuild. You know, the book starts, even if we just look at Watergate, which isn't as bad as any of those, the book starts with really looking at the way in which a politics starts to be reformed in the wake of the Watergate scandal and new measures are passed. Congress enters into a new era. A lot of those changes don't last, but there's an effort there to rebuild it and to move into a new period. So one of the beauties of America is our constant ability to strive for that more perfect union, right? Mm-hmm. And that comes from a recognition of our flaws and our willingness to address them and move ahead.
Kevin, is there anything else our listeners need to know about this era and about your book?
Well, I think maybe one thing to think about is to revisit things like the 1980s. It's usually told as the story of the Reagan Revolution, a period of conservative dominance. What we found there are that things were really starting to change at the grassroots level. They weren't visible just yet, but change bubbles up from underneath. And so we see in that period, say, take the issue of the AIDS crisis, right? This is something that the Reagan administration laughs off. Literally, Larry Speaks, the spokesman in the White House, jokes, oh, no one here has AIDS, ha, ha, ha. And they don't even Reagan doesn't even talk about it until Rock Hudson contracts the disease later on. Fast forward 15 years, you've got another Republican in the White House, George W. Bush, and he makes a case And a very important one, one of the most important things he does as president is presses the global fight against AIDS. And again, there, as Reagan had relied on the moral majority to kind of keep him away from supporting anything that seemed to support or help the gay community, George W. Bush uses his religion as an argument for this. You know, we're not going to stand on the wayside. We're not going to ignore the stranger in need. So it's really a remarkable change, and one that wasn't visible at the time, but it's bubbling up from the ground. So that's maybe a big story that runs throughout the book. There are countless moments like that of these things that aren't really apparent in the moment, but are really starting to gain traction and can be revolutionary in the span of just a decade.
Kevin M. Cruz is the co-author, along with Julian E. Zelizer, of Fault Lines, A History of the United States Since 1974. It's just been released in audiobook form. That way, you don't have to struggle to read it through tears of despair. Dr. Cruz is professor of history at Princeton University, and his other books include The Essential, One Nation Under God, How Corporate America Invented Christian America. Kevin, it's always illuminating to spend time with you. Thanks for being with us once more on State of Belief Radio.
It was my pleasure, sir.
There's no question that every religious denomination has been struggling with the matter of ministry to LGBTQ persons. This is also encompassed questions of marriage equality and ordination. While some conservative churches are overtly condemning gay people and are, in fact, leading culture war battles to remake our secular society in their own image, a number of more progressive denominations have made great strides toward including and even celebrating their LGBTQ sisters and brothers. One of the nation's largest mainline Protestant groups, the United Methodist Church, confronted these questions at a special session of its general conference last week, and news reports are portraying the outcome as an overwhelmingly conservative victory. For details, I'm happy to be joined by Emily Miller, national reporter at the invaluable Religion News Service, and a journalist who has been covering the way this issue has been roiling the church for over a decade. Emily, thank you so much for being with us today.
Well, thank you for having me, and thank you for those kind words for RNS.
What were the specific questions the special session was confronting?
Well, the denomination has been locked in a stalemate over how it's going to move forward, over deep divide on questions of the ordination and marriage of LGBTQ members. At the last general conference in 2016, they decided to defer all conversation about this to a specially appointed commission and left the door open to a special session just to address how the denomination could move forward on these questions. Mm-hmm. So that special session proposed three different plans for the way the church could handle its disagreement on this. And those plans were presented this past week in St. Louis.
Well, you know, I'm going to ask you, what were the three proposals at the conference considered?
The plan that was recommended by the denomination's Council of Bishops is called the One Church Plan, and that would have allowed individual churches and regional annual conferences to decide whether to ordain and marry LGBTQ members. There was also a plan called the Connectional Conference Plan, which would have reorganized United Methodist churches by conferences that were based on theology instead of on geography like they are now. And then the third plan was called the Traditional Plan. And this would keep and even strengthen enforcement of the current language in the denomination's rule book regarding LGBTQ people. And that ultimately is the plan that ended up passing. 53% of the general conference voted for this plan.
Mm-hmm. How does that fit in with the many United Methodist congregations across the country that have been affirming for literally decades?
It's a good question. The plan was referred to the denomination's top court, the Judicial Council, and some of the petitions that were involved, the Judicial Council had already ruled unconstitutional even before the vote, and they didn't all get a chance to be amended.
Mm-hmm.
So the Judicial Council is going to have to rule how much of this plan can actually take effect, and that would happen on January 1st. So it's still a little unclear how much of this plan will actually take effect. Meantime, there are churches that have already left the denomination, even in the lead up to this general conference, not because they took a specific side of the debate, but just because they felt having such a divisive debate itself was a mm-hmm. distraction to their ministry. There probably will be people and churches and conferences that leave because of this decision. But most of what I was hearing in St. Louis, both from people speaking on the floor and observers and delegates that I spoke with afterward, I attended a worship service hosted by one of these groups that was opposed to the traditional plan afterward. Most of what I'm hearing is people are wanting to stay. People are hurt, but they are still feeling hopeful, and they're committed to staying and continuing to advocate for the full inclusion of LGBTQ people in the denomination.
Are you talking about clergy at that point, or are you talking about members in the pews?
I think a little of both.
Okay.
I think there are both clergy and people in the pews who are hurt and going to leave. And I think there are people who are hurt and are going to stay.
Mm-hmm. So there's been a lot of talk about schism from mm-hmm. conservatives in advance of the conference.
Mm-hmm.
Now that the people who were threatening schism have actually won the day on this,
mm-hmm.
what are advocates for inclusion saying? Are they willing to stay as well, or are they threatening to go up now?
You're correct. The Wesleyan Covenant Association, a group that had been advocating for this traditional plan, formed after the last general conference in 2016. And they were very clear coming into this general conference that if their plan didn't pass, if one of these plans that allowed for ordination and marriage of LGBTQ United Methodists passed, that they would recommend that they leave and form their own denomination. And they have about 1,500 member churches here in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
But that wasn't what I was hearing, at least from inclusive affirming churches ahead of time.
Mm-hmm.
I was talking to the Reconciling Ministries Network, which has been, you know, advocating for greater inclusion for decades now. And what we were hearing from them was LGBTQ United Methodists are some of the most committed United Methodists out there, and they didn't have a plan for how they were going to leave afterward. It was wait and see what happens, and then we'll discuss it and see where we are then. And from what I was hearing from people in St. Louis, there was a real commitment to stay and try to advocate and change things for the next generation of United Methodists.
Mm. It's really interesting because, as you said, they have been having this debate for a really long time, and it seems to come out somewhat the same way, and yet they keep going at it. I admire them. I actually come from a denomination that did divide, and I can't really understand, as I should perhaps, how those who are for inclusion are staying with the denomination, unless they just stay and go on doing what they're doing already. I want to ask you a question, and I'm asking you as a journalist. I'd like to ask a theologian in the United Methodist Church, and I'll probably ask this at some time.
But you're
a journalist that looks at the big picture, and I just wonder, during the debates, such as the one in the United Methodist Church, do you ever hear anyone make the point that this is not just an ecclesiastical issue? It is, in fact, a matter of judgment on whether or not LGBTQ people are legitimately human beings, or because of their sexual identity are less than human and undeserving of the ministry of the Christian church. I'm just interested in whether or not you ever hear that kind of debate on the floor of the conference, or is it all just about ecclesiastical politics?
That is often a point that people raise in these discussions, is that as Christians, they believe that everyone is made in the image of God, and that includes LGBTQ people, mm-hmm. and that this is a denial of their full dignity as human beings made in the image of God. Yeah. That's certainly something that I've heard a number of people reference.
Yeah. So tell me again, when's the next time the entire denomination will be able to consider this question, if at all?
It's just next year. Well, right now, all of the regional annual conferences are having their meetings coming up really soon. So they'll all be taking what happened here at this special session back to their regions and discussing and making decisions based on that. But the whole church gets together again just next year. The general conference is every 4 years, but this was a special session in between. So it'll be interesting to see what the Judicial Council decides in April, what this plan looks like after that, how it takes effect in January, and then if this comes up again next year in Minneapolis, and how.
I'm not going to ask you if you want to predict what's going to happen.
I think if there's one thing that I've learned now covering, I guess, one and a half general conferences, because I covered 2016 and now the special session, is that you cannot predict what will happen at general conference.
Emily Miller is national reporter at Religion News Service with a focus on mainline Protestant churches in this country. Her essential reportage of the earth-shaking developments in the United Methodist Church around questions of LGBTQ inclusivity is available online, and we'll link to it from stateofbelief.com. Emily, thank you so much for taking time to be with us today and to share important information and help us to know what to be looking for in the days ahead. You're always welcome on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you so much.
Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. Your generous support of this program helps keep us on the air week after week after week. If you've made a donation to State of Belief Radio this week, let me say thank you on behalf of every one of our listeners. If you think there's value in what you've heard here, please make your contribution today. Find more information at stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. Stay up to date by subscribing to the free weekly State of Belief podcast on iTunes or your favorite podcast platform. And take a moment to follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Our producer is Ray Kirstein. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. And be sure to join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief.
I think it's time we stop, children. What's that sound? Everybody look what's going down.